Today is Wednesday, October the 23rd. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. BigTech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. That's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, announced a new rule this week requiring all smartphones to be compatible with hearing aids. 100% of all mobile handsets, such as smartphones, must be compatible with hearing aids, the FCC says. With this change, the 48 million Americans with hearing loss will be able to choose among the same mobile phone models that are available to all consumers. Hearing aids became available over the counter in 2022, which has reduced prices and expanded access. It also cemented them as mass market consumer tech, removing the audiologist gatekeeper. Apple is leading the charge, obtaining FDA approval last month to certify the AirPods Pro 2 as a hearing aid. Pairing hearing aids with a mobile phone enhances the user experience, offering an easy interface to customize sound settings. Under the new rule, consumers can freely choose the mobile phone and hearing aid of their choice without concerns they won't work together. The FCC also established universal Bluetooth rules to discourage smartphone makers from implementing custom connections that could inhibit pairing. All devices must meet certain volume control benchmarks that ensure clear audio for the listener, including allowing them to increase the audio through the phone without distortion. This applies to both hearing aids and ocular implants. Phone makers must also clearly label devices to clarify if they meet all these rules. Hearing aid compatible, universal Bluetooth pairing, and volume control benchmarks, including how high the audio volume can be raised. The Federal Communications Commission did not provide a timeline for implementation, only mentioning the rule will take effect after a transition period. "23andMe to pay up to $10,000 to data breach victims. If you were affected by the recent 23andMe data breach, you may be eligible for compensation through a $30 million settlement. Here's what you need to know about the available payouts and how to file a claim. In October 2023, 23andMe revealed that approximately 14,000 customer accounts were accessed without authorization. The attackers exploited a credential stuffing technique using login credentials stolen from other websites to gain access to 23andMe accounts. While the company's systems weren't directly breached, the incident exposed sensitive personal information, including names, birth years, ancestry data, and information shared through the DNA relatives feature. The settlement provides for three main types of compensation with a maximum payout of up to $10,000 for specific claims. Extraordinary claims. Customers who experienced significant losses such as identity theft or incurred costs for security services may qualify for up to $10,000. According to HIPAA Journal and Tech, affected individuals in this category must provide documentation such as receipts or records of related expenses. The category is capped at $5 million in total, meaning payouts may be prorated if there are numerous claims exceeding this cap. Health and information claims. Customers whose sensitive health information was specifically exposed can claim around $100. This category includes health information compromised as part of the data breach and is limited to $750,000 across all claimants. Then there's statutory cash claims. Residents of California, Illinois, Oregon, and Alaska are eligible for a general compensation amount expected to be about $100 if they receive a breach notification and can confirm residency in one of these states. These amounts may vary based on the number of claims and total settlement funds available, especially since claims will be processed on a proportional basis if demand is high. Big tech is spending big on nuclear power. Tech companies are turning to nuclear power to advance their AI ambitions. From Amazon to Google, companies at the forefront of the AI boom are investing in nuclear energy to fuel data centers, which provide the infrastructure and resources needed to train and run AI models. Aside from generating enormous amounts of power, nuclear power is also an attractive choice for companies hoping to meet global net zero goals. Companies committed to strong climate goals must ensure their future energy needs are met with clean, carbon-free sources. Nuclear energy, with its unmatched ability to deliver 24/7 power, fits the bill perfectly. Here's a closer look at how tech companies are investing in nuclear energy. Amazon. Amazon announced it had signed new agreements enabling the development of several small modular reactors, which have a smaller footprint and shorter build times than traditional reactors, to power its data centers. Energy Northwest, a consortium of public utilities, will construct, own, and operate 4 reactors across Washington. Amazon is also investing $500 million in X Energy, a developer of small nuclear reactors and fuel. X Energy's designs will be used in the Energy Northwest project, the company said. Amazon is also partnering with utility company Dominion Energy to explore the development of a small modular reactor project near the North Anna Nuclear Power Station in Virginia. Amazon executives said nuclear power offers the cleanest energy to meet the demands of its large data centers. One of the fastest ways to address climate change is by transitioning our society to carbon-free energy sources, and nuclear energy is both carbon-free and able to scale, which is why it's an important area of investment for Amazon. Matt Garman, the CEO of Amazon Web Services, said in a press release. In March, the company also purchased a nuclear-powered data center from Talen Energy. Microsoft has a 20-year deal with energy supplier Constellation Energy. In September, energy supplier Constellation Energy struck a deal with Microsoft to provide the tech giant with nuclear power for the next 2 decades by resurrecting part of the Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Pennsylvania. A spokesperson for Constellation previously told Business Insider that it plans to invest $1.6 billion to reopen one of the Pennsylvania's plant's 2 reactors. Bobby Hollis, Microsoft Vice President for Energy, told Bloomberg that the Three Mile Island reactor will assist Microsoft in meeting its goal of becoming carbon-free by 2030, and that energy from the site will be used to expand data centers in Pennsylvania and neighboring states. Google announced an investment in Kairos Power to build small modular reactors. Google said it would purchase nuclear energy from Kairos Power, a California-based company developing small modular reactors. Kairos Power has nuclear projects in New Mexico and Tennessee. Google said it plans to bring the first small modular reactor in eastern Tennessee online by 2030 and continue with additional deployments through 2035. Overall, the deal will enable up to 500 megawatts of new 24/7 carbon-free power for United States electricity grids, according to Google. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman owns a 6% stake in nuclear reactor startup Oklo, O-K-L-O, which also develops small modular reactors. The company plans to directly sell power to customers through long-term contracts. It went public after merging with Altman's special purpose acquisition company in May. Last month, Oklo announced that the Department of Energy had authorized the company to conduct site investigations for its planned reactor at Idaho National Laboratory. Latest sign that constant job cuts are the new big tech norm. All eyes have been on the job market as investors wait to see if the economy will reach a soft landing. There are signs that layoffs are creeping up and job openings are drying up, according to an analysis by human resources firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, which specializes in career transition and outplacement services. Challenger, Gray, and Christmas examined the latest job openings and labor turnover survey and found that companies have announced 609,242 job cuts so far in 2024, an increase of 0.8% from this time last year. U.S. employers announced 72,821 cuts in September alone, a 53% increase from September of last year. Layoffs are being exacerbated by AI, the firm found. Companies are finding ways to adopt this technology and replace jobs. AI was responsible for 5,616 job cuts in September and 12,742 in 2024 overall. So far, all of these layoffs have been within the technology industry. Employer hiring plans are also on the decline. U.S. employers announced 400,891 planned hires in September, a 32% decrease from this time last year. This decrease is especially significant given that September is historically a peak hiring period as employers scramble to fill positions before the end of the fiscal year and the holiday season. These signs point to companies trying to boost profitability in a slowing economy through cost-cutting initiatives such as automating jobs with AI or reducing labor costs. In September, cost-cutting was cited as the reason for 15,750 layoffs. Another 14,054 were due to store closings, and 6,933 were due to general market conditions. We're at an inflection point now, where the labor market could stall or tighten. It will take a few months for the drop in interest rates to impact employer costs as well as consumer savings accounts. Technology topped the list for the most amount of layoffs of any sector this year. While tech layoffs aren't as rampant as in recent years, they remain elevated as companies recalibrate from pandemic overhiring. Although blue-collar workers are historically most impacted by economic downturns and layoffs, elevated tech sector job cuts indicate that white-collar jobs are at stake at the moment, and with a significant portion of these layoffs coming from AI adoption, it seems like there's more job disruption in the cards. After shedding workers and sweeping layoffs in late 2022 and early 2023, many tech companies are taking a more methodical department-by-department approach to making cuts. Major firms including Intel, Cisco, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft have announced sizable reduction followed by more modest trimmings. Unsurprisingly, even with growth in some areas, the drip-drip of reductions in the past couple of years appears to be making some tech workers nervous. In a June survey from Indeed that involved more than 1,100 U.S. tech workers, 40% of respondents said they expected to be affected if their company conducted layoffs. 7 in 10 said they start looking to other employers if their company laid off workers. Most of the recurring layoffs were in tech. That's likely because many companies in the industry grew quickly during the pandemic and are still adjusting. But those recurring cuts come with costs. For companies who are continuously laying off, it's not a sustainable strategy. Even small-scale layoffs can make workers jittery. The rise of technologies like generative AI and the threat of layoffs were pushing many in tech to build their skills. Tech workers looking for jobs are now more likely to apply for staffing firms, which might offer temporary gigs, or to roles in areas like healthcare than to tech firms. While some tech workers are drawn to the flexibility that contingent or part-time roles can offer, tech has historically been the number one industry tech workers want to work in. They're just not feeling that stability right now. Beyond what investors might cheer, the tech giants are getting older and no longer in growth mode, when their aim was often to snap up workers. Hence, many companies made cuts following the rush of hiring during the pandemic. Since then, some bosses have been looking to trim the size of their organization and otherwise make improvements. A sign that the tech industry might be closer to stabilizing was that, after declining for several years, job postings in areas like software development had remained flat in recent months, though they're still 30% below 2020 levels. Of course, that means that there are fewer opportunities for laid-off workers. It's an indication that companies are being careful not to hire too many people. It's not like they're going out and massively hiring and then doing layoffs. Rebecca Mercury is an early and tireless advocate for the necessity of transparently tabulated, voter-verified paper ballots. She has spoken before the House Science Committee, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and the Election Assistance Commission. Rebecca, what are the issues you feel are of primary concern with respect to this fall's general election, especially the presidential election?
Well, it's the presidential election, but it's all the down ballot races, local, municipal, Senate, House of Representatives. Everything is on the ballot. So, it can be in many of the states. So this is a big one. This is a very important election. And there are a lot of issues with regard to it. Between 4 years ago and now, many counties and states changed the methods by which they were having the election run. They may be using different equipment. They may be using different modalities of equipment. They may have different laws in place as to what can and cannot happen at the polling places. So a lot of things have changed. And a lot of people, even if you vote in the primaries, things have changed between the primary election and the general election. I had signed up as a poll worker, and they had to bring us all back in for additional training because some things had changed with the voting systems here in my county, which is Mercer County, New Jersey. It's the capital county of the state. So there are a lot of issues, and I want to address some that I feel are of extreme concern and that everybody should be looking out for. For one, instructions about how to deal with your ballot if it is a paper ballot are being sent out that are incorrect. Here in New Jersey, and I'm not saying that it's in all of the counties, but in some of the counties where they have a type of voting which they're referring to as a voter-verified paper ballot. But what it actually is, it's a computer that's printing out your ballot. So you go into this booth, there's a computer in there, the booth is activated for every single voter. So the person who's the poll worker there has a special card. They activate it. That way, additional votes can't be added, supposedly. Who knows? Maybe a rogue could do it, but whatever. So they activate the machine and then the ballot shows up, but it's not just, one thing. It's got all the different things that you have to go through and vote for. So you fill out your ballot the way you want it by making selections on, you'll see them on the screen as you go along. And then, so it's going through each of the different races. And then when you're done, you say, okay, I'm done. And so you press a button that basically says, you want to cast your ballot, but it's not going to take you directly to casting your ballot. what it does is it prints out on the screen the actual image of what's going to be printed out on a piece of paper that's right below the computer. It's coming out on a regular computer printer. Okay, so you see this ballot on the screen, and the ballot has all the things that you should have selected on it. And it may be double-sided ballot. So, again, if it's a very long, some of the counties don't have a lot. Some do have a lot of candidates and things. So it will just show you exactly what that printed paper ballot is going to look like. And here in Mercer County, it does look almost exactly the same as the absentee ballot. You can't vote a absentee ballot if you're going to vote in the polls. So you have to pick one or the other. But basically, since I vote absentee, I know that this looks like the same ballot on the screen as the absentee ballot. And then you're supposed to look at that and decide whether it's all correct, exactly as you wanted to vote, for the different candidates. And if you say no, it'll take you back and you can make some, changes. But if you say yes, then what it does is it now prints out a sheet of paper on this printer that is sort of down by your knee, and it's going to print that out with your ballot choices in it. Now, nowhere in any of the instructions that are mailed to every single voter in the state of New Jersey, the instructions that are on the screen, that are anywhere, nowhere does it say, take the ballot out of the printer and now check to make sure that it's the same as on the screen. And I can tell you again, because I'm a poll worker, or was working as a poll worker, it probably will be one again in the actual election, but I watch them because there's like a little curtain. So they have a curtain and you can hear when it's printing out, it's starting to print on this piece of paper, and you see their hand go down sort of below the curtain and they pull the ballot out. Now I can't see how anybody votes. That would be illegal. But I do see their hand pulling it out. And then the instructions say to deposit it into the ballot scanner. And I can tell you that 90%, maybe more like 95 or even 99% of the people who pull that paper out never look at it. It is trivial for someone to write software that changes what is printed on the ballot from what is printed on the screen. Now, they claim that, okay, these are all checked and certified machines and they all work correctly. But I can tell you that in one of my training sessions, there was a voter, we were in training. So they told us all to be, practice voters. So we went in and it was like George Washington versus Abraham Lincoln and stuff like that. So it was just, a silly ballot. But there was one of our poll workers who was being trained who pulled out his ballot and he said, no, this is not what was printed on the screen. And what do you think that the person who was an official for the county said to that person? They said, oh, that happens sometimes. Don't worry about it. What? Don't worry about it? Now, I happen to know the head of the League of Women Voters of the entire state of New Jersey. I have had numerous conversations with her and told her, you need to alert everybody to this, that there are problems between what's on the screen and what's on the paper. And again, most everybody who I talk to about this say, oh, but it's printing out what was on the screen, so you don't have to check it. Wrong! That's the whole problem with electronic voting. I'm the one who coined the phrase voter verified, V-E-R-I-F-I-E-D, not verifiable, voter verified paper ballot. When you do not look at that paper ballot when it's printed out by the computer, then you have not voter verified it. And the problem that we are having right now is that this entire scheme of the way they've put this together and convincing people that that ballot is the same as what you saw on the screen is just bunk. It violates all of the rules of computing. It violates all of the rules of security. It violates all of the rules of making sure that you really did verify that ballot. And we do not know what's going on inside of these machines because the machines are not able to be inspected independently. And we have not tested these machines. In fact, as I say, they've been just changing them, you know, routinely. So what you need to do is get the word out about this. This is a big problem, and you need to let people know about it. Before the election, pull the paper out, look at it, and if it's wrong, go out and complain to the poll workers and stand there until they fix it. Okay.
Okay, so I was going to ask you, what do you do if it's incorrect, and you say go to the poll worker?
Go to the poll worker. There are poll workers there, and you tell them, you demand that this is not correct. And then if they have to, they're going to have to call somebody in the county to give you permission to redo it. But you need to do that, and you need to report it. You need to, I'm not saying you should report it to the police, but maybe you should. But you need to report that this happened to you and report it to news reporters, because everybody needs to know that this is happening. And again, we don't know why. We don't know if it's an accident. We don't know if it's deliberate, if there's problems with the programming of these things. But these problems are happening. And we know this, but nobody is doing anything about it. So to call these voter verified paper ballots, I would say no, they're not voter verified, because the vast majority of people do not ever look at them. They just grab it out and then they drop it in the scanner. And again, well, that's because I've seen that with my very eyes.
Let me ask this question then. Suppose what is printed is what you want. How do you know it's recorded the same way?
It is. If it's on the piece of paper, when it goes into the scanner, okay, they do not tabulate the votes from the computer. It goes into the scanner. And then the scanner should be tabulating correctly. But again, do we know that? Is there any way of knowing that? And this is what gets me to what Donald Trump has been saying. Donald Trump has been saying, we should be counting physically the paper. The paper is what we verified. Some states still do the manual, fill in the dots. And I do the manual because that's the way, that's why I choose to vote absentee, because I know that those dots are filled in by me the way I wanted them. Voter verified. What happens after they get scanned? I don't know. And Donald Trump, I hate to say that he's right about anything, but on this, he is right. He has never contacted me. Some of his people have tried to get him to contact me and talk to him about this. And he is right that we should be voting from the paper, but the way or counting, voting on the paper and counting on the paper. So also the great thing about having, paper ballots is that you can have people all over the room filling them out at the same time and then dropping them into the scanner or dropping them into the ballot collection box. And it doesn't take any more time. So you could have 20 people in the room voting instead of having to wait one at a time to go into the machine or, you know, slowing up the line. So the one thing I do want to say about what Donald Trump is saying is that people should be sitting there counting the ballots. He does not propose a methodology, which I do have, for the way that you would count them. And that methodology is known as bin counting. I'll leave you to look that up in your computer science literature. But if you do it in bin counting, it's what we call an order end. The number of ballots, it will take you that long to count one race. So you don't go through them multiple times. You just put them in bins and then you count what's in each bin. And that could all be photographed. You could have cameras showing that. We can't have cameras when you're voting because that would give away how you voted.
Now, in New York City, where I vote, we're given a big, huge cardboard piece of paper. It's really very large, and it lists everything on it. And but there is no booth. There is no secrecy. You go to a little small space table, and people can walk by. Okay, I don't get upset by that. But I have two problems with it. They fit everything, multiple languages on it, and being a senior citizen, it's like it's so tiny print, and if you make a mistake, there's no way of making a correction.
Yeah, that is a problem. And I know that they do have visually impaired ballots that you should be able to request. But New York has just gone crazy with this because they have so many different populations and so many different people. You know, maybe they should just have, okay, you want the Spanish-speaking ballot? Here you go. You want the Chinese ballot? Okay, here you go. But they don't do it that way. I think it also creates problems in the way it's laid out. And so because of that, you couldn't really have a way to do this properly as far as being counted and things like that. But that's New York. New York has always done things with, you know, a lot of expansiveness. Well, not always, but at a certain point they decided to go to that. But so then what happens to your ballot in New York? Where does it go after that? Do you drop it into a scanner?
No, you take it to a scanner and it is scanned.
And then it scans it in. Okay. So
the paper is kept so that if they had to do a verification.
Yes.
The only complaint I hear from people about is they have to print all this stuff and there's an extra cost to do that. You know what? If you're going to do it, you do it the right way. You don't consider costs that can have errors.
Right. Well, as it turns out, the trade-off between the cost of these electronic voting systems and the amount that they have to print is it's in favor of the printing. I mean, the printing, you have to have that anyway for the absentee ballots. So you're really creating two separate systems. That would now just be one system. It's just they print those paper ballots. They have those all printed, you know, by sometimes a union company or sometimes it's some of these voting machine vendors that actually are printing these paper ballots. But, you know, people like to complain about the cost of it. No, it is not more cost to do that. It will be the same, if not less. So that's an incorrect assumption. But what you have in New York is, in fact, a voter-verified paper ballot method, because if the voter is actually doing the dots themselves and marking off what they want themselves, they're verifying it as they go along. So that is voter-verified. And that's a great system. And by the way, I had spent many years giving testimony in front of the New York City Board of Elections, I think even once before the New York State Board of Elections, and I was a strong proponent of this all along. So you have a great guy there at New York State. His name is Doug Kellner. He's an attorney by trade, but he has been involved with the elections, and he's one of the few sane people in the state of New York who has really, for decades now, I'm saying like three or maybe even four decades, has been promoting the proper way of voting in New York. So hooray for Doug Kellner.
Rebecca, thank you very much. Let's continue with this next week because you probably have a lot more to say.
Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how IT is evolving, or sometimes how it needs to evolve. I've been in the industry for over 35 years as an IT professional, and that is actually quite a long time. I've seen so many different things over the years. It has been just an amazing just experience for me. And there are different companies I've worked for which treated me as just a technical resource. Oh, we need this server fixed. We need this taken care of. We need you to go fix printers, desktops, fix the network, whatever it was. And it was all a matter of that technical knowledge. But over the years, I've built up a set of knowledge that allows me to go forward and work in a mentorship kind of role, a guiding role. As a matter of fact, where I am in the industry is a little bit more guiding. It's a little bit more observing. It's a little bit more of seeing what has happened over my career and making sure all of those different pitfalls that we've run across in all of those different situations doesn't happen again. We don't fall into those different holes and can't find a way out. So mentorship, and this is in the form of active mentoring, but also passive mentoring. This is an area which needs to be focused on across IT. We need to be finding a lot of the different ways where we can coach all of the different IT people to do better for themselves, for their department, for their IT department, and for the company, but all of technology. And yes, you may say, okay, isn't mentorship just like babysitting? Well, okay, no, not really. It's not handholding. It's about guiding. It's about educating. It's like handing them the map, but letting them figure out how to get from point A to point B. This is allowing the person to develop, the person who's being mentored, the mentee, to discover new ways to do things that they haven't thought about before. These are soft skills that you're going to be just using, but also relating over to those other people along in there. Yes, I can go and I can say, you need to do this, 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 and this. And that's how you get it done. But in IT, if I give those, you know, four instructions, this, 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 and this, that is only if everything works the way it should. And in IT, we know that it doesn't. In IT, there are so many different interrelated things, some of which have bugs, and somewhere along the way, it's all going to fall apart. So I have to say, you're going to do these four things, but somewhere along the way, something might break. So what do you do if that third one breaks? Okay, so think about that. Tell me how you're going to handle it if this goes wrong. Okay, we can back out or we can change this. We can do whatever. Look, I want them to think about what they're working on instead of just following the instructions. So along with all of that hardcore technology that one must have in the IT industry, we need to, and there are companies that are starting to look for those. We need to chase after those soft skills, that ability to communicate like a human being. And yes, it's going to involve patience. It's going to involve building people up. It's going to involve talking to people. These are problems. All of those are problems with people who are in the IT industry. We're not used to building people up. We're not used to communicating on the phone. We're used to communicating via Teams or email or whatever else it is that's out there. Slack. You know, it doesn't matter which one. So in a way, we have to juggle a lot of the different expectations, and we have to shift these, and we need to be encouraging all of these different things. Look, if I'm the only person who knows how to do that ABCD set of instructions, what's going to happen if I'm not around? Chaos. But if I start to help people understand, this is what we're going to do, this is why we're doing it, this is how you're going to do it, and this is what you do if something goes wrong, I start building better people who are going to have confidence in their problem-solving skills. They're going to be far more competent than when we started before. Like there's nothing more satisfying than seeing someone who used to stumble and they used to trip over all of the different things in their job, and now they are running at full speed because of your guidance. This is a really big thing. Mentoring is not about just the people who are learning either. It's about the person who's teaching. And the more that someone teaches, the more that they learn. And when you see someone succeed because of your help, your setup, your mentorship, it feels like you're passing on a torch and you're lighting the way for the future. And I'll tell you, that has been just a joy for me over the years. And I hope for many years to come. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
The FIDO Alliance, which is the Fast Identity Online Alliance, released an online resource to explain why passkey technology is superior to passwords and how businesses can adopt it. A global tech industry group devoted to ending the Internet's dependence on passwords has released a set of resources that it hopes will usher in a new paradigm for how we sign into things online. The Fast Identity Online FIDO Alliance, which is composed of tech companies, password managers, retailers, and government agencies, believe that passwords are insecure and inconvenient, pointing to the large number of users who forget passwords, reuse passwords across sites, and have their passwords compromised in data breaches or phishing attacks. Instead, the Alliance would like everyone to use passkeys. A passkey is a form of public key cryptography that replaces account usernames and passwords with random strings of data. Those cryptographic keys are stored in an authenticator, which is similar to a password manager and can only be unlocked by the same method a person uses to unlock their phones or other devices. For example, facial recognition, thumbprint detection, or a PIN. When you sign into a website with a passkey, you're prompted to unlock your device, at which point the authenticator sends the website the cryptographic key necessary to log into your account. The FIDO Alliance published Passkey Central, an online guide explaining how the technology works and why everyone should be using it. At the same time, the organization released draft credential exchange specifications aimed at standardizing the way organizations transfer user credentials like passkeys between each other so that users can move their login information between devices, operating systems, and password managers without compromising their security. More than 13 billion online accounts across platforms like Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Nintendo, PayPal, and TikTok are currently able to use passkeys, according to the FIDO Alliance. The group hopes that Passkey Central will spread awareness and provide all the information other businesses need to implement the new system on their websites. Craig Newmark, founder of the Craig Newmark Philanthropies, which helped underwrite the Passkey Central project, said in a statement, "Our adversaries attack nations in cyberspace using techniques that are blocked by passkeys and related technologies. We need to do what we can to accelerate passkey adoption and to help regular people understand that passkeys protect countries and make their online lives a lot easier." What are the pros and cons with passkey versus password? In the evolving landscape of online security, passkeys and passwords represent two distinct approaches to authentication. Each has its own set of advantages and disadvantages, which can significantly impact user experience and security. What are the pros and cons of passkeys? Passkeys are designed to be more secure than traditional passwords. They are resistant to phishing attacks and data breaches because they do not leave the user's device in a form that can be intercepted. Users can log into accounts more quickly and with less hassle, as passkeys eliminate the need to remember complex passwords. Since passkeys are cryptographic keys that do not involve text, they cannot be easily stolen or reused, minimizing the risk of identity theft. There are accessibility issues, though. Users must have their passkey available at all times, which can be inconvenient if they forget or lose access to their device. There are adoption challenges. As passkeys are a newer technology, not all services support them yet, which can limit their usability. And what are the pros and cons of passwords? Passwords can be used across a wide range of services and platforms, making them versatile for users. Most users are accustomed to using passwords, which can make them feel more comfortable with this method of authentication. Passwords, though, are prone to being stolen through phishing, data breaches, and other attacks. Users often reuse passwords, which increases the risk of multiple accounts being compromised. Many users struggle to create and remember strong passwords, leading to weak security practices. While passkeys offer significant security advantages and conveniences, they also come with challenges related to accessibility and adoption. On the other hand, passwords provide flexibility and familiarity, but are increasingly seen as a security liability. As technology evolves, the balance between these two methods will likely shift, with passkeys becoming more prevalent in the future.
Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, what do you have for us this week?
Listen, yeah. I can answer one of those technology questions immediately. Yeah. People, just remember this. It's Lefty Lucy.
Okay.
Righty tighty.
Lefty Lucy. Yes. Okay.
All right. Now, what were you going to say, Ben?
I was wondering what you had for us today.
Well, I've got a little something. Everybody know anybody who doesn't understand how big 8 centimeters is.
Okay.
A little over 3 inches. So imagine you had something between baseball and softball size, but it's a cube.
Okay.
Well, Cube, K-U-B-B, sent me the Cube Mini Fanless Cube PC.
Oh, which is, okay.
Which is about that size, and it is a respectable PC in that little case that doesn't need the constant fan.
Oh, nice. So it's a little fanless. Okay.
Yeah, nice. It's using the Intel Alder Lake N100. Mm-hmm, it's got 16 gig of DDR5. It's got an M2 SSD with 256 gig standard. There are other options up to a terabyte.
Yeah. Yeah.
3 USB 3.2 ports, type A, an audio connector to HDMI 2.0s, and RJ45 for Ethernet with Windows 11 Pro pre-installed, or you can get it without.
Okay.
Pricing roughly between $290 and $350. So the question to consider is, an inexpensive space, generous little computer like this.
Yeah.
Where would you use it?
Where would I use it? Easy. I would use that for offloading some of the computing stuff that I do around here. I would use that as like a test bed for a lot of those different things. Yeah.
Knowing you, you'd use that for a lot of your home automation.
Yeah. Possibly. It is a good direction to go in. With something like that, it fits anywhere. So you can set it up. And also probably one of those arrangements where you can remote control it as well. Utilizing something like any desk or whatever. So you don't even have to have like a monitor on it. It can serve as a remote system that has everything you need on it.
Want to stick a whole line of them in the attic, right?
Sure.
And stop the cosmic rays from coming down into your bedroom.
Yes. We are going to just radiation-proof the home, or at least the master bedroom. Yes, okay.
So, we've been to the small dimension. You care to go to a long dimension?
Okay.
Imagine a USB cord that is 31 feet long.
A USB cord, okay.
All right. Sure. I got one from Tether Tools. It's their Tether Pro.
Yeah.
And it comes with what they call Tether Boost. Now, Tether Boost is a one-way USB buffer amplifier. And there are two of them along the length of it. So it's roughly every 10 feet. There's a USB-C straight connector on one end and a USB-C right angle on the other.
Hold on. So USB-C, you didn't mention, you just said USB cord. USB-C, that's 32 feet, 31,
yes,
32.
Yes, sir.
30 feet. 31. That's a lot. That's amazing.
Yes, and it's a little thicker than most because it's handling good bandwidth. And this is a one-way cable that's optimized for professional camera-to-computer connections.
Okay, and for those of you listening, he's showing me the cable. It is distinctly a larger size cable. We're talking for
power
you and
cord
I.
Size.
Yeah, power cord. Yeah, I was going to say XLR, yeah. But yeah, power cord, definitely.
Yeah, now it's got high throughput. It's data centric. There's no power delivery on the wire. It can handle 5 gigabits.
Okay, yeah.
Which not bad for USB-C on that distance. Now to help the signal span the distance, those tether boost amplifiers are in line. I also want to mention for the pandemic expanded work at home segment.
Yeah.
It's a solution to reaching not quite right here gear.
Yeah.
Printers,
yeah.
Scanners, projectors, that kind of thing. And remember, the economical off-the-shelf hubs make a lot of ports like Ethernet and HDMI and so on available from a USB-C connection.
Yeah.
So you've got a way to beam your USB-C across the room on a big orange tightrope. That's a Tether Tools Tether Pro 31-foot. USB with tether boost. So
that's a nice distance. I remember struggling somewhere around the 50-foot mark for USB A. Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you can make it go further, but USB C is typically 10 foot is the largest you can reliably get without the booster. The booster
12 to 15, 12 to 15 if you're 3.2.
Okay.
USB
All
3.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of a key differentiator there with that booster in there.
And remind me, we should do a segment very soon now on USB 4.
Yes. That would be that'd be definitely a good thing to come up with. So you've got a little bit of the cutting edge technology between the little that little PC there and the thick 31-foot cord. That's good stuff.
Oh, fat and orange. You don't want to trip on it.
Yeah. You can't miss that one. It's just like, as you mentioned, big, huge lawn extension cord. Don't mull over it. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting Thursday, October the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting. Website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, November the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. TED Ed Connect meets Tuesday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and is Zoom only because the library is unavailable for Election Day. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is wpcug.org. Kingsbyte Computer Club meets Tuesday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, and the number to confirm is 347-278-7320. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, November the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, November the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is nyacc.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.